This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Bill Hammack. Now, we all know of the technological revolution in media, and instead of a television and a radio, we now have an alphabet soup of choices, iPods, DVDs, and even YouTube. What's the effect of all of this on us as consumers of media? Well, what happens when new and old media collide? Today, I'll talk to an astute observer of the media scene, and he'll share with us how traditional media and the new media are blending together to create what he calls a convergence culture. And I invite your questions today at 333-WILL if you're in the area, or if you're anywhere else in North America, call me at 800-222-WILL. That's 333-9455. 800-222-9455. And keep in mind that you can listen to us also at www.will.uiuc.edu. So let's welcome to the Afternoon Magazine, Henry Jenkins.
Happy to be here.
Well, in your book, you cast a very wide net to show how all communications technologies impact traditional media. And so I want to start with television. Now, I'm sure many of my listeners here have seen the CBS television series Survivor, but I think few of us really know that something called a knowledge community sprung up around the show. And could you describe what that community is and what they do and how that's an example of what you call cultural convergence?
Sure. We're talking about a phenomenon called spoiling, which started by simply people trying to find out what's happening on Survivor before it reaches the air, realizing that all those events on that island took place some months ago by the time we were watching it on network television. So spoiling has grown up to be a quite elaborate game played by the fans who are trying to track down information. And it starts now with fans trying to figure out which island it's going to be, where in the world is Survivor going to be set.
And so Survivor is done completely in secret by the CBS and their producers,
right? It's tightly secured set. It's in secret. It's shot months in advance. Only the outcome is withheld until the last minute. So the fans begin to tap social networks around travel agents and try to find out mass movements of personnel from CBS to some remote part of the world. They then go to satellites and look at satellite photographs of the island and have been able to identify the base camp from the air and learn a lot about what the challenges might look like in that way. Then they begin to try to track down the contestants and try to figure out who these contestants are. Someone from the cubicle across from you has disappeared for 3 months, came back sunburned, covered with leech marks, lost 30 pounds and won't tell anyone where he's been for the last 3 months. That gets alerted to the community.
So the contestants
checks
are
all that out and becomes very adept at identifying pretty much all 18 of the contestants before they're announced by the network.
And the contestants also sign a secrecy contract.
They're supposed to be sworn to secrecy. So, and in the last phase now is, post the story that I tell in the book, is increasingly they're pulling their money and sending people to the location itself, interviewing hotel clerks, maids, finding out who went back to the hotel first, trying to piece together information that way. So that by the time the new Survivor, which will what hit the air in a couple of weeks now, then by the time the new Survivor hits the air, the fan community knows almost everything that's going to happen on that show, despite massive efforts by the network and producer Mark Burnett to maintain security on it. And they do it because they operate within what we're calling a knowledge culture or collective intelligence, to use another word. That's a world where everybody knows something. Nobody knows everything. What any individual member knows can be tapped on a need-to-know basis by the group as a whole. So it's a collective process in which people pool their knowledge, combine information, vet each other's information, contest each other's information. And out of it, they become very, very good at coming up with very accurate forecasts of exactly what's taking place on the show.
And so one of the keys here is that they use the internet, bulletin boards and other ways to communicate, and it's able to link a community across the nation and across the world, right?
Yeah, I mean, the internet allows, it's the principle of 6 degrees of separation. The internet allows these people to connect with people who know people, and it's easy to trace that out. and they build up a global social network of people they can draw on that get information.
So this is one of the prime examples where the new and old media collide, as you say. And your argument is that they're watching the show in a very different way than in the past when people watched the show rather passively.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Internet has fundamentally changed the collective process we have to make sense of a show. I first observed this when I was doing some work on Twin Peaks 15, 16 years ago.
Could you remind us what Twin Peaks was?
Twin Peaks was David Lynch's mystery serial, you know, about the who killed Laura Palmer. It was kind of a, you know, it was the lost of its era. And at the time, newspaper critics were saying Twin Peaks had become so complex that no one could possibly follow it. If you were following the online community, they were saying the show had become so simple that they were losing interest in it. And it suggested that what we can do together in an online community is radically different than what we can do as individuals in our living room. So television since then has had to become much more complex to support the kind of active activity of these various fan communities. Because even if the average viewer is not a member of this community, information filters down. Casual viewers know they can go to the web and read some summaries of episodes or now download episodes they may have missed. There's a whole infrastructure that's emerging around new media that supports following much more complex serial dramas than we did before. And Survivor is simply the reality show equivalent of one of these complex serial dramas.
So let's take a look here. What you're describing is a very active, high-tech fan base, that, if you will, that's linked together by the Internet. Now, fan clubs have always existed, but because of this connectivity, as you describe it, how does this change the form of the show? I mean, how is the content of Survivor or other shows changed because of this?
Well, in the case of Survivor, I think a lot has changed by Mark Burnett's eagerness to play cat and mouse.
And Mark Burnett is the executive producer?
Mark Burnett is the executive producer. Okay. He's trying to play, sort of throw the fan community off base, throw out misinformation, false leads, and so forth. And I think the show is built to encourage this speculation and debate. So while fans may have carried it to an extreme that maybe no one intended, the idea that you might speculate about the outcome of Survivor, that you'd want to track down information about the contestants, that you'd want to be in the know about what's happening in the show, is built into that program. It's a show that's designed to solicit very loyal viewing at a time when most shows are not appointment television, but reality TV. Does encourage people to tune in every week and watch at a regular time and to be aware of the information around it. It's a show that encourages gossip, which is sort of social networks help draw viewers into a show. It's a show which encourages people to go to the web and seek out further information. Mm-hmm. And from both the producers and advertisers' point of view, that's advantageous because it means, quote, multiple touch points, to use the industry's term. It means people keep coming back and seeing the brand and seeing the show content again and again in the course of the week. So Survivor is designed to solicit this kind of behavior. It's just the spoilers take it to the logical extreme. That is, because they're better organized and better at processing information than a casual viewer, they're able to push that much further than I think any producer in the show might have imagined.
Now, maybe we could give some specific examples of the way that the content of these shows are changing. In the case of Survivor Africa, one viewer at least thought that there were real hints from the producers about who was going to win based on that person's name. Can you describe what that viewer detected?
Well, basically, they started noticing a pattern of lens flare whenever a certain character appeared on the screen. And they began to imagine that represented a kind of religious allegory, which is not that far-fetched when you consider how often Survivor juxtaposes contestants with footage of animals to suggest one's a snake or one's a rat or whatnot. Metaphoric editing is very common on reality television and Survivor in particular. And they spotted from episode one this pattern. They did an elaborate analysis with clips and so forth that was up on the Internet, and it turned out they were right, that indeed Follow the Star proved to be correct, and from episode one they calculated who won based on the editing patterns.
And in the case of Survivor Africa, there was actually this biblical imagery, and the person who won was named, was it Peter?
I've just lost his name.
It's a biblical name. It's Peter or Paul, if I remember.
Yeah, it's definitely a biblical name, but I'm just
blank. And this is what the editing led people to. So when we've looked at Survivor at a very specific example of convergence, and when you talk about convergence of media, Is this just a simple blending of media because of technology? I mean, something like a big black box that runs all media? Or do you mean something that really happens in a user's head in how they use media?
I think we can mean either. The industry wants to reduce convergence to this black box. And I don't know about you, but I have more black boxes in my living room than ever before, and the remotes aren't compatible, and the cords are tangled. And, you know, I don't think it's about the black box. I think convergence, for me, describes a world where every story, image, brand, relationship gets conducted across the maximum number of media channels. It's being shaped by top-down decisions made in corporate boardrooms and bottom-up decisions made in teenagers' bedrooms. It's both companies wanting to exploit any intellectual property they own across every possible media platform, and it's consumers wanting the media they want, when they want it, where they want it, and the form they want it, and being willing to take it there illegally if the company isn't willing to provide it there legally. So Napster and the illegal downloads are part of convergence. So are the unified strategies of rolling out a media franchise across multiple markets. It all works together to create a logic where all of the media are interconnected in our heads, in our homes, through our technologies, or not.
So, you know, you're looking here then that it really alters the logic by which media industries operate and by which media consumers process news and entertainment. So let's look at an example where this convergence breaks down the walls between methods of communication, like, say, the telephone and things like newspapers, television, the internet. And we saw with Survivor, a lot of fans became involved. Can you use this idea of convergence to help us understand the appeal of a mega hit like American Idol?
Well, we talk a great deal in the book about American Idol, and it was by design both a platform that connect television to the recording industry and to stage performances, concerts. It was put on American television in part because Coca-Cola wanted a vehicle to promote its brand, and so
product
placement was from the very beginning part of what drove American Idol.
Well, let's look at Coca-Cola right away. I think of Coca-Cola as a soft drink bottler. But you're arguing that Coca-Cola, through American Idol and other things, is becoming something different. And what is it that Coca-Cola is really becoming?
Well, Stephen Heyer, who was at one time the CEO of Coca-Cola, spelled it out and said, we're not a bottling company, we're an entertainment company.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're looking at building an emotional connection between the consumer and our brand, Coca-Cola. We're interested in doing it by partnering with the entertainment industry in such a way that certain brands, you look at them and you can't think of them without thinking of Coke. And American Idol is the flagship of that strategy. There's no accident that the contestants wait in a red room that's Coke red before they go on the air. It's no accident that Simon and Paula and Randy are drinking from Coke cups regularly on the air.
Mm-hmm.
It's no accident that the concerts are sponsored by Coke or that the contestants appear at other Coke-sponsored events. There's cross-pollination. Coke is as absolutely central to American Idol, and indeed American Idol arguably is on the air because Coca-Cola wanted it to be on the air.
Well, let's probe that a little bit, because product placement is very old-fashioned. It's been here for a long time. But maybe you could share with us a little bit about how American Idol evolved. One has the image that Fox said, hey, we have this show, let's go find a sponsor. Tell us how that process really worked, though.
Well, in this case, it was a question of the brand. There was the producers and brand found each other, and then they sought a network that was willing to transmit the show.
Mm-hmm.
So it's quite the opposite we might have imagined. And increasingly, this is the case, that brands are looking for ideal emotional vehicles to shape the relationship they want to have with consumers. They're connecting the content producers very early in the process, and then they're trying to argue that, you know, that there's an economic model that supports the production of the content.
Mm-hmm.
This is occurring in a moment when TiVos and VHS machines are making it very easy for consumers to fast-forward through commercials. So we're moving back to an era where product placements are going to be very central to the economics of television, and it's coming at the same time that we're seeing the emergence of what I call affective economics.
Affective.
This idea, affective, or is an affect is an emotion, the idea that we are trying to build emotional connections between entertainment properties and brands, that fan loyalty to the entertainment property translates into brand loyalty on the part of the consumer. And that's the underlying thesis of a lot of the movements that are taking place in the advertising and branding world right now. They want to create stuff that are emotionally compelling, that make us want to feel we have personal stakes in their brand, and therefore that they hold on to us as stable consumers of their products over time.
Well, you use the phrase in the book that producers are moving from impressions to expressions, which I think is an example of what you're talking about, or the root of it. Can you explain what you mean by impressions to expressions?
You know, the old model of impressions was just how many eyeballs are watching my commercial. Mm-hmm. And you look at a gross count of how many people are watching a commercial at a particular time. The expressions model is what are people doing with the information I've given. It may have started with click rate on the net, where suddenly for the first time you could see not only who watched the commercial, but did they act on it, did they click through, did they seek out the product, did they buy the product. In television terms, there's nothing quite as immediate as that, but they're looking for what's the emotional stakes of the audience in what they're watching. They're looking for loyals. And the research coming out of the entertainment industry suggests that loyal viewers are incredibly valuable for a number of reasons. From a network point of view, they watch the show every week. They watch the entire show. They seek out the show through other means. They'll download it. They'll buy DVDs and so forth. From a brand point of view, they're more likely to be in the room during the commercial. They're more likely to remember the commercial product. Again, because they're more likely to seek out the product, the show through other means, they're also more likely to encounter the brand multiple times. And they're more likely to be an advocate for the show and the brand together. So the goal is to create someone who not just sees your ad, and not just goes out and buys the product, but becomes part of a brand community that mobilizes support around the product and introduces new consumers to the product.
So when we say impressions to expressions, we're looking now at a very fragmented market, and instead of just have people see our ads, we want a higher quality type of viewer. We want perhaps fewer viewers, but a richer experience that bonds them to the product in some way.
That's correct. And we want a viewer who's going to act. It's not about a passive relationship. Mm-hmm. It's about an active relationship to the brand and content.
That's where the new media comes in, through text messaging, is this correct, through internet,
sure,
and through others, people are involved. So you mention in your book something called zappers, loyals, and casuals, and you mentioned loyals a few minutes ago. Could you define those and then explain to us how a show like American Idol is really designed to create loyals?
All right, so zappers are simply people who shift from channel to channel constantly while watching TV. They're grazers. They're the guys at the cocktail party who's always looking over your shoulders trying to see what the next interesting conversation is going to be. Mm-hmm. Casuals are people who tune in for a particular show but may not necessarily come back next week, that they split around, look at the TV guide, figure out what they're going to watch in a particular evening. Loyals are those people who come back week after week to watch a particular program.
Mm-hmm.
Turns out for any given show on television, the typical show only has about 10% of their audience are loyals. The rest of them are casual viewers or zappers. For some shows, the loyals may be 60-70% of the viewership. Those tend to be reality shows, cult shows.
What is it for American Idol, for example? Is that a very high?
That's going to be very high, 60% or so. Mm-hmm. So the goal is to have a structure that it supports all three, but creates incentives for you to keep coming back and watch from week to week. So when we did our observation of American Idol viewers, we saw in a household, say, there might be a couple of loyals who watched every week. They would alert the other family members, insist that they watch that show and not some other, draw the people from the corners in to watch. Maybe the father comes in the room only to watch the final wrap-up and then help decide how to vote. The same thing happens in a dorm space, where it starts with a handful of loyals. Gradually, they pull some casuals in, get them to watch. Over time, those casuals become loyals. This is built into the structure of the show, which both has enough redundancy to allow people to quickly catch up and figure out where they are in the series if they're a casual, but has a strong hook through serialization and makes us want to watch week after week. That's the difference between American Idol, which it builds over time, and a classic talent show on television, which might play out in a single evening, might have six contestants, at the end one of them's chosen as a winner, and the following week it's a totally different set of contestants. American Idol has been very good at building serial in, which helps encourage people to tune in week after week after week.
So you're saying part of the genius to American Idol is it appears to be designed for zappers with bite-sized chunks, but you can watch them in or out of sequence, and it builds to some level of engagement or emotional involvement.
That's right. So it could, mm-hmm, you could watch one song, but I think very few people who do, mm-hmm, who watch it, will simply stay through one song because the narrative hook of which of these young people is going to go on, mm-hmm, to be the American Idol becomes so compelling over time. They do a great job of filling in backstory and the emotional stakes for each of these characters. Mm-hmm. that the melodrama pushes you forward and you want to find out what happened.
This is Bill Hammack, and I'm talking with Henry Jenkins, Director of Media Studies Program at MIT, and we're discussing the cultural transformation that occurs when old and new media collide. And I invite you to call with your questions at 333-WILL. If you're in the area or anywhere else, call me at 800-222-WILL. That's 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. And I'd like to go to caller on line 4 from Kankakee. Kankakee, please go ahead.
The term convergence is a technical term with meaning in many of the sciences and in a variety of contexts. The disambiguation page in Wikipedia is quite large for this caller. Convergence is a word that directs toward the book series by Ruth Nada Anshin. But would you define again for us, please, the word convergence within your context?
Well, one of the reasons the word gets used is because it has been such a central word in the way in which the entertainment industry and the technical fields deal with this. It actually traces itself back. I trace it back to Ithiel de Solo Pool's Technologies of Freedom book, which came out in the mid-1980s, who first started applying that to media. But what I mean by it is a system or a cultural logic within which every story gets played out across the maximum number of media platforms. So I'm interested in the flow of media, the interconnected logic of media, rather than simply a technological link between two different platforms. So what the technological links between platforms matters because content flows across those platforms. Well, I'm saying that when the content flows across those platforms, it doesn't, that it's significant and it represents convergence even if those technologies are not yet linked.
Let's look at some examples of that convergence that mix media. I mean, are there examples where a narrative arc or story is told in various media?
Well, I mean, a classic example I talk about in the book would be something like The Matrix. The Matrix is a story that was told not across just three feature films, but by a succession of short animated shorts produced by animators in Japan and Korea, by three games now, by a variety of comic book stories, which are not redundant to each other. It's not like you have a novelization of the film. Each of those media carries different pieces of information that's essential to understanding the experience of The Matrix. More recent example might be Lost, which had the Lost Experience alternate reality game this summer, a game that extended the universe of Lost and brought in a lot of information about the Hansel Corporation. Something like Heroes on NBC this season, which has comic books on the web, which extend the backstory of the various characters on Heroes in very interesting ways. So those would be an example of stories that are extended across multiple media platforms without the technical notion of convergence that content necessarily flows. It doesn't matter that the comics aren't readable on your TV set, that the games aren't playable in the multiplex. The logic, the world that's created around these fictions extends across all of those platforms.
So let's take a look at The Matrix. If I understand you correctly, you're saying there's the DVD version of The Matrix, or the theatrical release also, video games and animated shorts on the web, which all combine to create a Matrix experience. Now, are they telling parts of the story or the same story completely?
Well, the logic has shifted from a focus on stories to a focus on worlds. Veteran screenwriter explained it to me. He said, when I first started, we pitched stories because stories made great movies. Then he said, I pitch characters because characters were needed to create sequels. And now I pitch worlds because worlds become a platform that support multiple stories about multiple characters. In the case of The Matrix, for example, the character of Niobe, the Jada Pinkett character, plays minimal role in the feature film, becomes absolutely central as the protagonist of the Enter the Matrix game. The case of the kid, another character in the Matrix films, small roles in the second and third Matrix movie, a central role in one of the anime that was released around the movie. So, you know, the world is added, we add up all the information about the world across all of those media channels. Parents may be more familiar with the phenomenon of Pokemon, and Pokemon's a case where there's as many as 250 different characters that kids might potentially learn about and might potentially buy. But there's no one place you go to learn about all those characters, Pokemon exist in film, it exists on television show, it exists on games, mm-hmm. both computer games and card games, and various books. To find out I mean, all the information about those characters, one has to read across all of those different media.
Mm-hmm. So in the case of The Matrix, there are actually viewers out there that use all of these media and get a very different Matrix experience, than I get from just going to the theater once. Is that correct?
And I think people who maybe only saw the films came away with a very much more disappointed in the experience as a whole, because there were a lot of holes in it by a classical film standard. Those holes were filled by those other media. So the ideal viewer of The Matrix is someone who plays games, reads comics, watches anime, goes mm-hmm. to the movies, and has devoted many, many more hours to the phenomenon, literally hundreds of hours to the phenomenon, mm-hmm. than the guy who just goes in the multiplex and plops down his money and sees the three films. And that's kind of the transitional point we're at. Now, the reality is very few people do all of that, mm-hmm. but if they participate in an online community, the online community will hunt out and bring together that information, and collectively they'll build a concordance that gives you the background you need to understand any given piece of the Matrix complex.
Now, in my own lifetime, media has become on demand. And I mean, when I was a kid, one watched Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer that one time that it came on. And how has this ability to view something anytime we want really changed entertainment and changed the form and content of it?
Well, I think if we look at the television season this year, we've seen a dramatic increase in the number of serialized dramas, many of which have, quote, failed by network standards. But I think what we're discovering is that serial dramas do well in an environment where people can pick them up at any point in time. That if I decide and word of mouth comes that Heroes and Jericho turn out to be the serial dramas that have done the best this season, and Ugly Betty, I could now go back and watch all of the earlier episodes of Ugly Betty, download them from the Apple iMusic store, mm-hmm. catch up at any point. That means that the network can support a much more complex serial structure, knowing that I can take on some of the responsibility of bringing myself up to date, mm-hmm. that word of mouth can spread quickly in an internet environment and bring viewers in, but that shows may reach their full audience much slower than they did in the past because there are more media options, mm-hmm. and it takes people a while to find the particular show they're interested in.
So in that case, and a little bit what we discussed before, we're talking about the responses of fans to a particular show like Survivor, American Idol, or reviewing Ugly Betty. And in those cases, they dissected, they discussed, they examined every aspect. Is there any impact from fans that actually create a product, a homage to their favorites?
Well, I mean, certainly fans are creating their own versions of the show. They're circulating on the internet. Mm-hmm. You know, Time Magazine named you, as in YouTube, the person of the year. So there's a growing interest across the entertainment sector in this user-generated content. That user-generated content informs decisions in the studios to some degree, but even more, you know, significantly now what we're seeing is that becomes a recruiting ground for new talent. Mm-hmm. So if we take, for example, Doctor Who, the British television mm-hmm. series, this science fiction series, this is a show that had been on for 30 years, 40 years, got canceled, was off the air for 10 years, and has just come back in the last 2 years and is doing phenomenally well. If we follow the story, the fans are the ones who kept that show alive for those 10 years, kept building up interest in it, mm-hmm. kept creating new content. And then when the show came back on the air, many of the executive producers and writers they hired were part of the fan community that had sustained Doctor Who through those dark ages. So when the show came out back on the air, it's been very, very successful with fans because it's created by fans and gives those fans exactly what they were looking for in that particular series. So, you know, the same thing seems to be going on right now with Star Trek, which is now off the air. The television show is being written as fan fiction, is being staged as fan cinema, and sooner or later is going to come back into production again. And I lay odds that much of the talent that produces it will be recruited from the people right now who are writing the stories and making the movies about it.
We have a caller on a cell phone, so caller on line one, please go ahead. No, I'm sorry, we've lost that call. Well, let's return then to the to some of these parodies that fans are creating, like, for example, of Star Wars. In those, you certainly get copyrighted elements. Does this present then a dilemma, really, for media corporations?
Yeah, I think media companies are totally caught in a bind in terms of all of this. You know, in the book I describe two kind of poles of attention that's shaping these media companies. One might be called the prohibitionist logic, which is, that's my intellectual property, you don't touch it, you're stealing my stuff, I'm going to sue you, I'm going to send the cease and desist letter, I'm going to shut you down. and maybe that's the legal department side of this. The collaborationist model is, wow, I want to build this emotional relationship with my fans. I want to produce a show that fans are interested in. I want to use fans as viral marketers to stimulate greater interest in my product. I want to enable user-generated content and collaborate with my audience to create something more valuable than I can create just in-house. And that may be the marketing division, maybe even the creative division. Mm-hmm. So there's this tension between those two poles that shape the way any given media company responds. So the company will encourage people to use their logos, put them on their T-shirts, wear them, hang them on the wall as posters, you know, sew them onto their backpacks. And the minute they put that same logo onto their website, they get hit with the cease and desist letter.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the fans who are confused in that context. It's the company that's confused because it can't decide what relationship it wants to the fans. Everyone understands we're moving to a more participatory culture. No one can agree yet on what those terms of participation are. And so it's two steps forwards, one step backwards in the context of most of these companies.
So we have a trade-off. There are some short-term financial benefits, I would guess, to controlling your property. But is it true that the long-term benefits of having an active and involved fan base can be very substantial?
I mean, it's certainly my belief that long-term you're better off leaving some control and enabling fans to support what you're doing. The prohibitionist model starts in the assumption that fans depreciate the value of a property. They damage it through their misuse or overuse of it. I start from the premise that fans appreciate a property in the double sense, that they like it, they appreciate it, and in the economic sense, they increase its value. And indeed, the connection is between the two, that their passion for it drives them to put in extra hours, generate extra publicity, generate new content, offer fresh ways of thinking about it, mm-hmm. sustain the life of a property over time in ways that's much more valuable to the studio than maintaining a tight policing of intellectual property is likely to be. I think that's the direction the entertainment industry is moving right now. We see it, for example, in the decisions of networks to tolerate the circulation of their content on YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
You see it in the slowing down of cease and desist letters from studios to fan fiction writers. You're seeing it in a variety of ways. There's a reassessment going on of the value of this audience participation. An interesting story about it is the story of Serenity/Firefly. Firefly was a science fiction television show, got canceled. It was brought back as a feature film called Serenity. The Browncoats, the fan communities, were central to the publicity around the release of this film. They really stirred up interest in this mm-hmm. film. The media coverage was mostly about their fan support. When it was all over, Fox Studio decided to try to reclaim from them money for the illegal use of images from Firefly and claimed that they had violated their intellectual property. The fan communities gathered together online, tallied up all the amount of hours they put in support of the film, and then sent Fox Studio an invoice for billable hours,
mm-hmm.
saying that their man hours more than outweighed any violation of intellectual property. And Fox, after considering it, tore up its cease and desist letter and said, you're right, that we got much more value out of this community than it cost us.
Our caller, a cell phone caller on line one has returned. So let's go to line one.
Hello. I wanted to tell Henry Jenkins that I read his blog and I've been enjoying it very much. Speaking of the Serenity example he just used, I was curious about what he thought in terms of the convergence culture, what this means for producers. That producers may, in fact, become these central figures for entertainment production simply because they not only produce independent different productions, but then those productions themselves spin out these larger communities that become this kind of self-sustaining thing for future projects on that on those different worlds and settings that they have created. How does he see the role of the producer in the future in terms of what's occurring now?
Well, you're absolutely right. The producers play a very important role as community leaders in this environment. They have to anticipate their audience and is their response. I use a term in the book, textual activators and cultural attractors and cultural activators. So a cultural attractor draws together a like-minded group of people. A cultural activator gives those people something to do. So if we look at J.J. Abrams and the case of Lost, he gives the audience something to do in every episode, feeds that community. In the case of someone like Josh Whedon, he really courts that community. In the case of J. Michael Straczynski of Babylon 5, he literally went online every night and talked to his fans. So the producer becomes that interface between the creative community and the fan community, and I increasingly trust the fan community to support him. I could imagine, you know, the equivalent of diving off the stage into the audience being a realistic possibility in television before much longer. That is, going to a subscription-based model of television production in which the audience literally pays for the production of the show they want to watch. Such a model would allow producers to create fresh content with a smaller market than network television demands and still maintain that close relationship to fans. So I think we're going to move toward a world where that relationship between the fan and the producer has real economic heft behind it and starts to dramatically shape production decisions. We'll reach a point where the producer comes to the network and says, I've got an audience, do you want to buy it? In the same way that we suggested Coke went to Fox and said, we've got a show we want to produce and want to sponsor, are you willing to put it on the air?
I want to look a little deeper at some of these copyright issues. And I'm thinking of Harry Potter here, which has some very amazing fan sites. I'm looking, for example, at www.fictionalley.com, which has some 30,000 Harry Potter stories written by fans. Now, did the author J.K. Rowling and her publisher Scholastic feel the same way about these as did Warner Brothers, who produced the Harry Potter movies?
Well, the Harry Potter story is complex. I mean, J.K. Rowling early on really gave tacit approval for fan fiction. She was excited that her books were inspiring young people to write and share stories with each other and so forth. When Warner Brothers took over the rights to it to produce the feature films, it fell under a well-established studio regime, which sought out sites that were unauthorized and shut them down with cease and desist letters. When they started to do that with Harry Potter, they rapidly discovered that they were sending out cease and desist letters to 12- and 13-year-old web editors, shutting down their fan websites, and this was generating enormous anger around the world. But these young people were actually networked together, as one of them put to me. They started going after kids in Thailand and Poland, and they had no idea. We already knew those kids in Thailand and Poland, and we were able to draw together really quickly a children's campaign to stand up to Warner Brothers and challenge it publicly for the decisions it was making. And in that case, Diane Nelson, the executive at Warner Brothers, who was in charge of this, realized the problem from a public relations point of view, rerouted and reworked Warner Brothers' policy to support a lot of the fan activity and to be much more permissive of the production of fan fiction around Harry Potter. So this is a case where the studios learned and adapted to the demands for greater audience participation, having initially studios taken a legal hard line and tried to shut down the sites.
So for corporate media, there's both a value to this intense fan participation, but in fact, we really focused on how corporate media has, you know, if you will, co-opted new media. That's not quite fair. It's been a little more even-handed than that. But are there any cases where this has really gone bad, where the old medium truly didn't want the fan participation and legitimately really felt threatened?
Well, I think we'd have to decide what it means to be legitimately threatened.
Mm-hmm.
The case of the recording industry and Napster might be the case on the other end, where the recording industry really, truly believes that Napster damaged their record sales and, in fact, may have done so in a way that they've never been successful at regrouping from.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's a debatable proposition. Many people would argue that Napster, in fact, encouraged people to sample music and try new music, much the way radio is traditionally done around music. Others would point to reasons why the recording industry has failed, you know, over time, you know, overproduction, you know, lack of new marketing venues, lots of other factors play into that. The record industry is pretty convinced that they got gouged by Napster and never recovered.
Mm-hmm.
One could also argue the record industry, in seeking out to sue its fans and antagonize its consumers, so charged the water around this that fans began seeking out music and other channels, and the distribution channels like MySpace, where local bands can share their own music where their communities have taken off and have become much more significant as fans have looked for ways not to buy records from companies that sue them, which seems like a fairly rational response.
This is Bill Hammack, and I'm talking with Henry Jenkins, director of the Media Studies Program at MIT. He's written a book called Convergence Culture, Where Old and New Media Collide. Well, so far we've really talked about entertainment and how it's affected by the convergence of new and old media. But, of course, media does much more than entertain us. They also inform. So do you see any kind of convergence in our political discourse or actions? I mean, would convergence affect, for example, a presidential election?
Well, I think we're seeing some pretty vivid examples of that right now. It's significant that Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, mm-hmm. and Richardson all announced via the web. that Hillary Clinton's big thing right now is let's chat with America and let's use the web to build these smaller communities of support around a candidate. We certainly saw, you know, Howard Dean push that to the logical extremes in the last election cycle, where he demonstrated you could raise massive amount of money from small donors by tapping the internet. We certainly see it around groups like Meetup, which are tapping these grassroots production communities of people who make amateur filmmakers, encouraging them to make political commercials and distribute them via the web. We saw it with, Move On did that. Meetup is an interesting case where an organization created to support the trading of Beanie Babies turned out to be a very powerful tool for bringing political organizations together in the last election. True Majority in the last election used fan appropriation style to create a video where The Apprentice, where Donald Trump fires George W. Bush. And it was a sort of used the aura around The Apprentice to and re-editing footage from The Apprentice and from the news to create a kind of political message. We go down the list. The Daily Show becomes and Colbert Report become significant sites where young people get information about political events. Mm-hmm. So we're seeing this fusion between popular culture and politics, and we're seeing this fusion between old media and new media. We're seeing the no sooner does a new platform emerge to popular culture than it's taken up by the political process and used effectively. So we're already hearing about Senate candidates who've announced their candidacy through Second Life, the multiplayer online game world. It's only a matter of time before a presidential candidate becomes an avatar in a game world and uses that to reach out to voters. In China, we've seen massive protests in game worlds, tens of thousands of people marching through game worlds to protest political policies. This is in a world where there's real risk of physically standing up against your government, but avatars in a game world can make a very powerful political statement.
Well, this is very interesting, because what you're focusing on here with this collision of the new and old media is how do Americans find each other? How do they self-organize? How do they collaborate? How do they take political action? And that's where the popular culture enters. And this is a very interesting point, because many critics of the media focus strongly on the obstacles to achieving a more democratic society. In fact, they emphasize the power of big media in an often frightening way. Would it be fair to say that you're less pessimistic?
Well, I'm definitely less pessimistic than that. I certainly care about the concentration of media, and I certainly care about debates like net neutrality, which has been an important debate about making sure that we have a space that allows our participation. But I also see many, many ways that we use popular culture as resources, as communities, to talk about things that matter to us. Indeed, you might argue at the present time that that we can have more chances to talk about shared values and visions for the future of America through fan discussions around popular television shows than we could through, say, political discussion groups, which tend to be sharply divided on partisan lines, and Red America and Blue America aren't talking to each other. To paraphrase Barack Obama, we watch 24 in the blue states and we watch West Wing in the red states. We watch shows that don't necessarily support our own ideological visions, and in talking about those shows, we end up talking about our values, our concerns, our everyday lives in new ways. So the fan discussion list brings together a broader ideological spectrum and creates something they have in common to talk about, which could pave the way for us redefining what a purple America looks like, what an America that's not divided by red and blue, but that works towards some common vision of the future.
Henry, we have only a minute or two left, but I have one caller, and I want to try to get them in if they have a short question. So we have a caller from Urbana, line one. Please go ahead and be aware that we just have 90 seconds to 2 minutes left.
I noticed when you talked about music and Napster that you did not mention that the majority of the RIAA was convicted of price fixing, and that might have been part of the whole to-do about not wanting to buy stuff over the counter. Could you spend 1 minute addressing that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's plenty of reasons to believe that the recording industry has overpriced and, you know, done things that make their product unattractive to the American marketplace right now. And the blame Napster for that is, I think, a misunderstanding of what's going on. The other thing I point to, people think Napster was all about stealing music. Look at the success of the iMusic store. People seem willing to pay for the music if the price is reasonable, if being operating within the law is easy, if the variety is there, and so forth. So I don't think it was ever about stealing music. I think it was about having access to and sampling a broader range of music than they could hear on the radio.
Henry, thanks for taking the time to chat today.
My pleasure.
I'm Bill Hammack, and I've been talking with Henry Jenkins, author of Cultural Convergence, Where Old and New Media Collide. The technical director for this segment was Henry Frain, and the producer was Harriet Williamson.